When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And he was one of our players, and he played the psychic, Karina. And as a way of getting round, not having to do anything on camera, he claimed he was allergic to everything. So he was like, you know, because there's the lemon grove in it, and where there's the weird lemons you pick off the trees. The first thing he says, oh no, I'm allergic to lemons. And I thought, that is brilliant, and it's so the character. So we wrote it into the character that she would claim to be allergic to things to get out of doing them on the camera because she wants people to take her seriously.
I am fascinated by the process of collaboration and the creation of content. I sit down with Bud from Bud's RPG Review YouTube channel and the prolific scenario writer Alex, and we talk about their new Modern Cthulhu scenario, Viral. For their first outing as a writing team, it's an impressive piece of work, and I really enjoyed finding out who does what and how they work together. This episode, like all the content coming from the third floor, is only possible because of the support on Patreon. A big welcome to our newest floorheads: Nathan Emery, Mary McCurtry, Roland Suljic, Restored Thought, Motto Automato, GM Scott, and Stephen Palmer. Okay, sit back, relax, and enjoy my time with Alex and Bud.
Stand over the dead bodies of all the demons you just slayed in this room without breaking a sweat, only to discover that the door is locked. Okay, you roll lockpicking. Ooh, no. Okay, how about you roll strength to break it down? That's a fail too. You're stuck. Crap.
Hey there, Ron from the Dungeon Society. When I'm not making customized 5e D&D content or printing 3D tabletop miniatures at home, I'm listening to Tabletop Talk. Welcome.
Howdy, friends. Craig here. Today, we're talking to Bud from Bud's RPG Review YouTube channel and Alex Galat, publisher of over 30 RPG titles on DriveThruRPG. Together, they've created the modern Call of Cthulhu scenario, Viral. So, Bud, let's start with you. Welcome to the third floor.
Hello.
I'm fanboying a little bit. I've been a huge fan of your channel for a good bit of time. And between you and Seth Skorkowski, everything I ever need when it comes to running Call of Cthulhu, I can go to either channel. So I appreciate you making the time.
That's good that you watch.
So, Bud, at one point, you knew nothing about this, right? You didn't know that you could roll dice, pull out a sheet of paper and pretend to be somebody else. And then it was put in front of you for the first time. Can we go back to then?
Well, I mean, my start with role-playing games started slightly before sitting around a table with people. Because there was a set of Choose Your Own Adventure books. Have you heard of Steve Jackson's Sorcery?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I got money for my, I want to say, 10th birthday. And there used to be a supermarket, not so much a supermarket, but like a chain of stores in the UK called Woolworths. And I remember going in with my £5 gift voucher. That was when £5 was worth like £50 now. And I saw this book that caught my eye called The Seven Serpents. And I didn't know it was book 3 in the series, but it just caught my eye. And I was walking around the store and I'd look at different things, and I kept on going back and looking at it. And so eventually I decided, I picked it up, brought it back, and then I thought it was an actual, just a novel. And then I read the beginning bit and I was like, oh, this is actually a game. And then from the first time I played through it, I was absolutely hooked.
Really?
And for many years, well, I was always saying, for a couple of years, I just bought Choose Your Own Adventure books and played those. And then one day in school, a friend of mine, We turned up for our lesson, and it was during, there was a lot of teacher strikes in the UK in the early 80s. And we turned up to the lesson, there was no teacher there. So one of our friends said, "What, have you ever played Dungeons and Dragons?" And we were like, I'd not even heard of it. And so he made up a little dungeon for us, and we played it in the hour that we had to just sit in the room. And then that's all I could think about.
Interesting.
For like the then going forward. And then the same guy a couple of weeks later said, how do you fancy playing something like a real role-playing game? And he whipped out, RuneQuest 2nd edition.
Nice.
Which I bought a while back, the box set of, and we only had the box set. So we only had the book, the box set, you know, your Apple Lane and the other scenarios. We didn't even know they existed. I thought for many, many years that RuneQuest was just that book.
Interesting.
And we just, we at the summer holidays, we used to go around to a friend's house and we played pretty much every day for 6 weeks.
Wow.
Just making up adventures. We didn't know anything about Glorantha. We didn't really care. You know, there was a spell called Detect Silver. I've often mentioned this when people have spoken about it, but in Glorantha, Detect Silver is to do with the Rune Goddess. We thought it was just for finding treasure. So we just...
Which is a reasonable assumption.
well, yeah, when you don't know the lore of the game you're playing, you know, that's where we went. And then from there, I progressed to... Then it was Judge Dredd.
Nice.
Then Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay. And I didn't play D&D, like, for using the books until AD&D. And I'm going to say 1989.
Yeah.
So my first thing was never the Red Box D&D. It was RuneQuest.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, so that was where I got my beginnings. And the first book I ever bought was Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 1st Edition. And I still have the same book that I bought in 1988, 89, I think. And it's fallen to bits, but, you know.
Yeah, so seldom those books survive their parents and moving and going to university and stuff like that. So good for you. So, Bud, you are no longer in high school. You've got a couple more years in you than when you did when you were in high school. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you obviously vividly remember, you know, those adventures and those times when you were playing those games. Do you have a sense now as an adult looking back at that? Like, what was it that got Bud so hooked? Why did the Choose Your Own Adventure books grab onto you? And then why did sitting playing RuneQuest just occupy your mind?
It was I often found novels and television predictable.
Mm.
And I'm smart enough that I can normally work out what's coming. I mean, there has been the odd novel that's completely surprised me. But more often than not, an author will lay enough clues throughout a book for you to pick up where it's going to go at the end. But as I knew, my friends were writing adventures and putting us through all, you know, and this is at a time when you couldn't really buy that many adventures.
Yeah.
So you kind of had to write your own. It was the uncertainty. It was the not being able to predict what was going to happen next. That was kind of what I craved. And also, you know, you do kind of have rose-coloured spectacles about the whole thing, but to look back on the times you spent with your friends, it was a joyous, carefree time.
Yeah. Yeah. You know. The ability to just, you know, sit in like weekends, right? Like we would play for a weekend when we were that age. That meant we got there Saturday morning and we played for 12 hours. May have not ate, and then went to bed and went right back to playing it.
Yeah, that's what we did.
But as you kind of look at this history, right, you know, we talked about the beginnings, but I think it's also interesting, especially as we get into you as a creative, what were other big landmarks for you? Were there other times where you were into the hobby and then something, you came across something that made you just go, holy shit, like, I had no idea.
I mean, do you mean in the sense of like you read something, or there was a game that made you, that changed how you view games?
Yeah, let's start there. So, what were games that changed how you viewed the hobby and how and changed what you thought you wanted from the hobby?
I mean, to think more in more recent years, it'll be, and we're talking maybe 10 years ago, where I finally picked up the original Delta Green book for Call of Cthulhu.
Yeah,
I read it and I got in and I thought, that is one of the greatest role-playing books I've ever read. And when you know the backstory of Delta Green, you know, the big lie that's being sold to humanity and all that, I remember thinking to myself, why have you not read this earlier? Why has it taken you this long to get this game? You know, because it was released 10 years before I bought it. And it just kind of made me want to get, I mean, as you just look behind me, you can see, you know, what I'm like about that screen.
And so for those of you listening, he's got, and we talked about it in the green room, he's just got Delta Greens that takes up an entire shelf. And it's, I'm so envious.
I've got other weird bits that have Delta Green things as well, which you probably haven't seen. Like the, because Rachel Ivy for a while, I contacted, and they had this thing. I think they took 10 stamps, you know, like rubber stamps, Delta Green ones, to Gen Con. And I messaged Rachel, said, can I have one? And, you know, because obviously I promote what they do loads on, you know, because I love the game. And one of the guys I know, Dr. Cowie, he was at Gen Con. So they passed it to him. And I got some sew-on patches and things like that as well. And with the Kickstarters, I went all in on all three of them. Like, everything can print. And the amount of people who've since said, I wish I went all in for these because they're so good when they release them.
Well, and here's the thing about what they do is, you know a couple things. One, you're not going to get it tomorrow, but it's going to be worth the wait because, you know, they have a very solid, transparent policy, which is we're going to release them when we're done. Yeah. And the amount of love and effort and pride in their work just comes through. Absolutely. So, I mean, I backed the most recent one, which is going to be, you know, bring back to life some of the original content and stuff like that. And I know that when I get it, I am not going to regret the wait nor the price because it's going to be gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous. So, Alex, let's talk about you a little bit. Welcome to the third floor.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, my friend. So, similar question, right? So, at some point, again, you didn't know anything about this hobby, and it was put in front of you, and I'd like to go back there.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So, my first introduction was a birthday present. I got the original basic D&D set, which had the dice that you had to actually, like, color in the numbers with the crayon that comes with it, and
with the crayon, yeah.
Oh, yeah, it comes with a little crayon, for those of you who don't know, and it's young to know, but it's, yeah, you get the little crayon, you actually had to fill in the little numbers so you could read them, and it had, like, Keep on the Borderlands and sort of all this classic stuff, but it was all just, you know, Saddle Stitch, you know, books and the original thing, and I remember after getting it, just, you know, sitting there on the carpeted floor with my friends just going over it and just immediately just picking up and starting playing it. We were playing it wrong. We had no idea what we were doing, but we were picking out enough to, you know, to attack our first gelatinous cube and you know, and that was just a blast. I was very young at the time. And of course at that age, you know, everything's about pretend, right? We used to do all this kind of stuff on our own anyway. You know, go out in the woods with, and do all kinds of pretending. But with this, it had the sort of structure around it, which was just, which was brand new. And so that was just kind of awesome for us. We really liked that, the story. And so we'd begin making sort of adventures for each other, you know, just, I think there was like maybe three or four of us initially. And then I just continued sort of, you know, I got involved in a group, in high school, and I think it started in junior high actually, and then we went through high school and just you know, kept on playing.
So Alex, as you're growing with the hobby, right, and you're playing all mm-hmm. through high school, one of the things I often hear from people, and I did this, is you end up taking a break, right? Your real job, other interests and stuff kind of pull you away from the hobby. Did that happen to you, or have you been playing straight through?
Oh, pretty much straight through. The only time I took a break was when I moved someplace where I moved away from the group, and we really didn't have a lot of people in the area, but no, pretty much straight through. We would take breaks from D&D because we would sort of take turns, and then we had a few people in the group who liked running other stuff, like what was it at the time, like Gamma World or Boot Hill, and then very occasionally, what was the other one? Top Secret? It was a spy one.
Top Secret, yeah.
I think it was Top Secret. And we used to use those kind of in-between campaigns as little kind of palate cleansers, I guess, to just sort of take a break from the other stuff. But one person in our group, he had an uncle who was, you know, an older adult. And pretty soon he was running campaigns for us. And so he would just run all these, you know, long involved campaigns for us. And, yeah, we just kept playing pretty constantly, throughout, you know, our early years into adulthood.
Alex, you know, and we're going to get into this here in a future segment, but you obviously, have spent a lot of time making stuff for Call of Cthulhu. So I'd be interested to know when you came across Call of Cthulhu for the first time and what impact that had.
I started looking into Call of Cthulhu probably in the early 90s, I want to say. I think it was. But I was doing some horror role playing before that. There was a Palladium book that came out. What was it called? It was Beyond the Supernatural or something like that.
I don't know that one. Nice.
The cover was just so, it just drew me right in immediately. And so I began to sort of write, stories and scenarios, you know, that I would use other system for, but it was all sort of modern horror.
No, I'm sorry, Alex. So do you find yourself drawn to that as a genre in general? Is that your favorite genre, or do you just, you know, you're willing to play anything and run anything?
I'm willing to play a lot of different things, but yeah, I think horror is probably my favorite. And I would argue that, you know, in many ways, you know, D&D is horror. If you took any D&D encounter and just put it in our world, it would immediately become a horror movie. You know, you're still fighting these horrible monsters, essentially. It's just that in D&D, you have more resources to fight them, I guess, in terms of like magic and special abilities and things like that. But it's I don't think of them as not horror, I guess. and
right.
You know, most of my players would probably agree that most of my scenarios that I make on my own, my adventures that I make for D&D, definitely lean more into the horror genre.
So let's deconstruct that a little bit if we could, Alex. So sure. It's obviously, we know what makes Call of Cthulhu horror, right? It's kind of given when we talk about it, but I think it's more interesting to say, when Alex runs D&D, how does somebody at the table go, oh boy, Alex really has a horror slant on this? Like, what's the elements you bring that change things?
I think ultimately good horror is about vulnerability, right? If the characters are not at any risk, then there's no horror involved, right? If there's no threat, you know, they can't be afraid of it, you know, right? So I think if you can make an adventure that puts the characters in real, genuine peril, you don't want to make it a no-win scenario because that's no fun for anyone, but the more threat and more risk involved, the more terror it can be. And then the rest is just sort of window dressing. You know, it's like, is it a sunny, bright, sunny day, or is it thunder and lightning? Is it raining? And one of my favorite sort of versions of that horror was able to really lean into it was the original Ravenloft adventure, which was, that was groundbreaking in for me anyway. Not only was it written very differently than most other adventures before that, but you know, the sort of isometric maps and you know, the lore behind it. It was a very different thing, and it was definitely my cup of tea.
You two gentlemen are separated by just a small little pond. And you know, up to this point, as we talk about the time that you each of you spent with the hobby, we've yet to talk about the two of you coming together. So when was the first time that Bud, that you kind of came across Alex?
Alex messaged me and asked if I'd like to do a review of one of his scenarios, The Pipeline, and sent me a copy. That's right, isn't it, Alex?
Yeah, although I think the first time we actually communicated was a play test, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, that's right, yeah. That was just before that. I'm quite into creating liminal scenarios, you know, the system Liminal by Paul Michener.
Yeah, Paul's been on the show. It's a great system.
It is. It's a great game. I've been lucky enough to actually have Paul run Liminal for me, and I've run it for him.
Oh, God, that's great.
It's a bit weird running it for him, because I knew the rules better than he did. And I asked Alex if he'd like to play test it, because I think Alex has become a patron of mine. And I just I put a little shout out there to say, anyone want to play test this scenario? And Alex came back and went, sure. And we got a group together. And I remember Alex created this really interesting character because obviously the world of Liminal, things are infused with magic is the whole point. And Alex's character was a guy called Vincent, who was a chalk artist, but his chalk art was filled with magic. And when people looked at it, it would move and things like that. And so we had this great game. And then I think you sent me the copy of the pipeline, which I did the review of. I know I got sent a lot of stuff, but I did the review of it and I thought it was pretty good. And then from there, when I got Impossible Landscapes, the whole point with Impossible Landscapes was I wanted to run it because that validates my review, my big breakdown review of it a bit more.
Yeah.
And so I've got a couple of guys like, Scott and Keith from the Titterpigs podcast, who are friends of mine, and Pookie from Reviews from Really I. And I had a few people I was thinking about asking, and I said, I'll ask Alex again because his character was really interesting. I didn't know what I was in for with the character he created for Impossible Landscapes. You wouldn't believe it if I told you.
All right. Well, pause real quick because I want Alex to tell me about his Impossible Landscapes character now.
Well, now keep in mind, I didn't realize that, I don't know if this is a mild spoiler or not. There's a time jump between sort of sections at the very beginning. Like you skip a few years in between, right? Yeah. So I made an older gentleman. Yeah. So I made an older gentleman who was a psychiatrist who was part of the MK Ultra program. And so he had this background in he'd already sort of been involved in sort of some covert, you know, government activities and so forth. So he was not new to that aspect of things. And but he was also, you know, into psychedelic you know, drugs and so forth. So he'd been through a lot. Let's just say he was right. Sort of burned out. And then he was recruited by Delta Green, but then, you know, but he was already in his, I think he was like in his 60s or something like that. When I had him, and then I find out that suddenly a 20 year time jump or something ridiculous like that. Was it 10 or 20 years?
Oxygenarian.
I'm like an elderly man who's lost his mind. He's you know, addicted to all sorts of drugs, and yeah, he's somewhat whimsical. But yeah, he turned out very different than I had originally intended. So.
It's every week we get a laugh out of it.
But that's the fun of this kind of role playing, right? Like even a character that you make initially, by the end of it, maybe nothing like you've envisioned, you know, as the story unfolds.
I talk about that a lot. It's a hill I'll die on, which is, you know, you can sit there and you can create a character and write 550 pages, whatever, of backstory and have this entire concept. You have no idea who that character is until it hits the table, until mm-hmm. you put yeah. on that skin and actually start playing it.
Exactly.
And which is why I'm not a huge backstory person for that reason. But boy, that sounds like a lot of fun, especially for the GM.
Well, I'm the GM.
Right. But did you warn him and say, dude, like you're going to be 80 years old pretty soon?
No, because I wanted him to find out for himself. But the worst point is, obviously, you know that, you know about the whole thing about the yellow sign. It features throughout Impossible Landscapes. The first thing he did when we got to find the yellow sign was climbed in the back of a cab, drew it, and then said to the cab driver, have you seen this?
Oh, my God. And did you do that knowing the whole Yellow King thing, Alex? Or
Oh, yeah.
Okay. That's amazing. Oh, that's great.
No, so to be fair, he just get a copy of the King of Yellow play.
Yeah,
I think he just yeah. read it. So
oh, okay,
he's very excited to share it.
Sharing is caring.
So the two of you are bonding over the game, right? You're playing together. You've played a couple mm-hmm. games together. I want to get a sense before we move to the next segment. When did you, either of you, start going, I think I want to do something more. I think I want to make something together. Where did that first happen?
Viral was originally a scenario for Liminal.
Interesting.
Called the, what was it called? It was the Twice Said Agreement. because it was to do with a Ouija board. And Ouija is Ouija, yes, yes. So it's the twice said, yeah, it's a double said agreement. It's a yes, yes. And it was set in Scotland, and it was a group of ghost hunters, which is fairly similar to what is in the scenario, going to an island in Scotland to do an investigation to do the million subscribers, but it was in the middle of winter. And it was all covered in snow. But in the liminal scenario, it's not what's in viral. It's a fairy that's bound to the island that's gone mad. And that's creating all the kind of ghosty effects. It's not actually evil. It's just crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned this at the end of one of the Impossible Landscapes sessions. Because we will often sit around and have a chat afterwards. And Alex said, that sounds like a really good idea for a Call of Cthulhu scenario. Would you want to work on something together? So I said, yeah, that'd be cool. Great. And then it just took off from there, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Because what we stripped out the things that we knew would work, you know, obviously the fairy thing wouldn't necessarily translate as well and some other things. And, I think, Bud, you came up with the idea of, cause you had mentioned that ghost hunting channel, I forget what the name of it was, who did that.
Oh, Ghost Adventures. Yeah,
where they actually went to this haunted island, and
Paveglia. And so it's off the coast of Italy. Yeah,
right. So this is sort of our version of that place. It's in a different location, but we decided to come up with our own version of that, and then it just sort of went on from there. And then the name Viral came up sort of naturally out of the story as we were sort of putting it together.
Alex is being very kind there. He came up with the name. Because when he showed me the cover he designed and he said, this is the title, I was like, that's perfect.
Because, that's so cool.
Because it has a double meaning throughout.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. Yep. It's good stuff. And we're going to have a whole segment about Viral. So guys, the Insider Insight series is my opportunity to sit down with designers, developers, artists, writers, and creators and learn how they approach their work. I try and understand their process, inspiration, and methods for crafting their creations. And that's what we're going to do with Alex and Bud today. We're going to take a quick break. When we get back from this break, though, we're going to talk a little bit about a YouTube channel called Bud's RPG Review. We'll be right back.
If you're like me, you love Blaze in the Dark by John Harper, or perhaps you've never played it. Either way, we've got something very special for you.
We are the cast of the actual play of Blades in the Dark on Third Floor War's YouTube channel.
Join me, Václav, Joe, Roman, and D. Nick Westbrook as our crew. The Umbrella means fight to control the underworld of Duskwall.
Blades in the Dark is the perfect RPG if you want minimal prep and exciting heist movie-styled action.
And like all role-playing game actual plays on the channel, you get engrossing roleplay combined with mini tutorials of the game's mechanics.
Veterans of Blades in the Dark can watch and see why John Harper himself called the show a great example of player-driven gaming using Blades in the Dark.
If you are new to the game, we will show you how the mechanics work, and you will see why Quince from the Shut Up and Sit Down, in his reviews of Blades in the Dark, proclaimed, "Blades has me wondering if I'll ever again find an RPG that resonates so perfectly with my friends and me."
All right, friends, go to Third Floor Wars' YouTube channel and watch us play. Each session is action-packed, full of great role-playing, and showcases why many RPG enthusiasts love Blades in the Dark.
So long before I bought Viral, and just by the way, I've got the hardcover. It's gorgeous. As somebody who runs a lot of Call of Cthulhu, I cannot wait to bring it onto the channel because it's super clever, and we'll talk a lot about that. But that's not how I discovered Bud. When I returned back to role playing and started putting together, you know, a group to play Call of Cthulhu again, which I hadn't ran in 20 some odd years. I came across Bud's channel. And if you have not gone to Bud's RPG Review, big plug. If you follow me on Twitter, you know what a fan I am. Bud's approach to it is very unique, and it's something to watch. But I don't want to talk about what Bud's channel is about. I want to get an idea of where it came from. So, Bud, when you think about it and go backwards, when was the first time you thought, you know, maybe I want to share my thoughts about these games?
Well, that's a question. See, the only channel I can remember from before everyone seemed to be doing them was Kurt Weigl's Game Geeks.
Yeah.
But he's really sporadic. He has been better recently, but he's really sporadic with where he talks about stuff. And he can be quite combative as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if he doesn't like something, he really tells you he doesn't like it, which I am fine with, but I can see why people would be rubbed up. If I wanted to find out about something, if I search for the game, it would always be on reviews from Relay, because Pookie reads like no one. He's inhuman how quickly he reads and writes reviews up.
Yeah.
So I came up with the idea of doing the channel. There's a bit of a backstory to it. It's going to sound bad, but I'll explain. Okay. I was losing my memory quite severely, right? Because I had undiagnosed obstructive sleep apnea, which was causing me to not be able to sleep. I was sleeping for 90 seconds at a time before being woken up by me breathing. Okay. And as a result, my memory was going. I would read a book and then forget anything about it, that any rules. I would go in and play games that I'd played for years and not remember how to do things. So through my work, we have private health insurance. I mean, as you know, in the UK, healthcare is free, but to be seen privately. So I got diagnosed with it and treatment for it. And then I noticed my memory was starting to come back.
Unbelievable.
So I started rereading the books that I'd forgotten things about, and it was sticking. It was starting to stick again because I was sleeping properly. And on the way to our games, my long-term friend of mine, Mark, on the way to our game every Wednesday, I pick him up and we drive up together. And I was talking about, I've reread this and is this right? And we just got chatting away. And I said, Joe, I should just do a YouTube channel where I explain how things work to people. And he was like, yeah, you definitely should, yeah. So I had a look online, and other than Kurt Weigl, it seemed to be more about people showing themselves than showing the books. And there was one particular channel, I don't remember the name of, but the guy literally had the book next to his face. I was talking about it and turning the pages like this. And I was looking at it thinking, I don't want to necessarily see you. I want to see what you're talking about. So that gave me the idea from there for my channel, with the idea that you wouldn't see me. It would just literally just be the hands. But it would be an entire focus on what I was saying. I want you to focus on whatever it is I'm showing you, right, and what I'm saying about it, because what I look like is irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I've got my wedding ring on there. I don't wear my wedding ring on any of my videos because it's irrelevant.
Right.
It just brings up what people will sometimes say, you know, they would ask you about, oh, I didn't know you were married. And that's irrelevant. So the idea was, I'd received treatment for the sleep apnea. And so I thought, right, okay, I'll create a channel. I don't know what to do. Come up with a channel name, went and grabbed everything to do with it, you know, like Twitter, all like YouTube. We grabbed all the bits that I needed to do. And then I put out my first video, which was Delta Green Agent Handbook.
Isn't that something?
And it was terrible, the video. The audio was recorded on my phone. Then rooted through Audacity. I didn't know anything about macros. It just sounded terrible. And the video was no lighting. It was the camera on my phone on a tripod. And yet somehow I managed to get 20 subscribers off this hot garbage that I put out. And fairly early on, one of my subscribers was Seth Skolkowski. I think he was one of my first 20 or 30.
No kidding.
Yeah, and this is when he had thousands at this point.
Yeah.
And I looked at his stuff, and Set stuff, as we know, is great. And I was like, I really need to up my game here.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where I've gone from there. I've tried to up my game each step along the way.
Yeah, and in fairness, or you look at, listen to, or watch some early Seth's, and Seth struggled from the audio video as well. And we all do it, right? We all go through it. So I love getting the backstory behind, you know, obviously the unique visuals of your channel, but you know, that's not it, right? That's not all of it. There's gaps that you must have seen that you said, I'm going to fill. So let's talk about how you approach this and, you know, what problems were you solving? So you said, this is not happening out there and I'm going to do this. I'm going to fill these gaps.
It was the kind of the deep dive and instructional, because this is another one that might be a bit of a ramble, but I'll get to the point eventually is, When I set out to do things like when I did Max and I'll Athletep over 17 videos, I do a complete breakdown of each chapter. Some chapters taking 3 videos because they're just too big otherwise. They're too unwieldy. And I have a patron who's got slightly diagnosed ADHD. And he's a super nice fella. He really is. And he messaged me and he said, just to let you know, I really struggle with sitting and reading. Mm-hmm. But when I can sit with the book in front of me, with you explaining what's going on, and it sticks, and I understand.
And that's something.
Yeah. So it was the idea that I could do big breakdowns of campaigns, not only to help me understand it, but to help anyone out there who's struggling to wrap their head around what's going on. And it's the bigger campaigns, obviously, like Impossible Landscapes, like it's any part video series. I'm currently doing 6 seasons in Sartar, which is a superb RuneQuest campaign. And that's going to be my kind of thing going forward. It's these big campaign breakdowns in multiple parts to help people run them. And to, you know, whenever possible, I want to run them. Because I'm going to be doing a series of face-to-face videos, but for patrons only, called Bud's Guide to Running X. And I've already written part 1 of Impossible Landscapes, how to run the knife floors, what I did and what I would do differently.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to be like a patron-only thing, and they're going to be face-to-face. They're going to be like, you know, with a camera.
So, but logistically, I've been curious about your process. So you identify what you want to talk through, right? Mm-hmm. What you're going to make the video for. Do you script it and then record, or can you walk me through, like, you pick something up and can you just give me an overview of your process?
Okay. So it's one of the questions I get asked the most is how do you get the audio and video and everything just sounding so good? And how do you remember all that? Well, I don't remember all that. I script out my videos entirely. I record the audio. And then when I record it, I have the audio playing and I essentially mime what I'm doing on the video, on the audio. And then when I import them in, because I've got the audio playing in the background when the video is recording, I can synchronize them.
Right.
So I just click a button, it synchronizes and it all matches up.
Right.
But I think, to be honest, the thing I've learned the most about since I've been doing the channel is perhaps surprisingly not video, it's audio editing. I've become a real dab hand at audio editing. You know, if I record a video that's like 40 minutes of audio with all the ums and ahs, the breaths, the retakes, the swearing, why did I write that? Talking to myself. I know I can normally knock like 25% off the size.
Right.
Just through tweaks and cutting little tiny bits off and, you know. And I think the audio is a big part as well, because some people I know have listened to my stuff in the car without watching the video.
No, the quality just from top to bottom is outstanding. So, you know, we obviously talked from an equipment standpoint, the journey you've taken, right, from the hot garbage first video to really the top technology and process you're working now. What have you learned, though, as a creator during that process? So if I were to go back and ignoring the obvious differences from an audio video quality, what would I notice your journey as somebody who's creating these videos? What have you gone through? What are you doing now that you didn't do before?
It's a hard one to answer that, because it's about how forgiven I've become.
Interesting.
Because if I pick up something by D&D, if they make a mess of something that's unforgivable, they have unlimited money to throw at it and a huge team. If I get sent something that a guy has wrote in his back room, on his own with no help and put out, I'm a lot more forgiving with that because you can see the love that's been put into something.
Right.
Based on, but just, but a lot, you know, you can see someone's just come with a good idea and ran with it. Whereas the bigger gaming companies, it's just like knock stuff out as quickly as you can to fill the gaps when we're meant to be selling something. Like the perfect example maybe would be the latest Spelljammer set.
Mm-hmm.
There's no excuse for that being as bad as it is.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's what I've learned. I've learned going forward. It's just to be, you find yourself being a bit more forgiving with the smaller creators because, you know, cut them a break here. I wasn't before, but I am now a small creator. You know, it's just to be a bit more kind for the smaller creators.
And that is a perfect transition into my next question, Bud, which is now that you've gone through the process from nothing exists to Craig ordered a hardback copy of your book.
Thanks, by the way.
You're welcome. I've mentioned it a few times. What has that changed as far as your perspective now, having gone through that process? Has that changed how you dig into the stuff you're reviewing and breaking down?
Not really.
How about the opposite then? How did the fact that you had spent so much time breaking down all of this stuff, how did that impact you creating Viral?
It made me more mindful. It made me more mindful of the things I don't like to read in books.
Mm.
And I think Alex would agree. I was always saying all the way throughout, no, I don't want to put that in because that kind of thing, it gets on my nerves. And we did so many little tweaks, but I think ultimately the little tweaks all the way throughout paid off.
Can you give me some examples of the stuff that you dropped out because it annoys the hell out of you?
Walls of text. Yeah. Occasionally I would say to Alex who was doing the layouts, and I'm sure Alex is going to have a come back at this and explain why, but occasionally he would send like a kind of pre-production thing and I'd be like, there's 5 pages there with no breaks. Can we shrink one of the pictures and put one of the pictures in just to break things up a bit? Because white space and things like that and breaks in pages are, for me, what keep me interested.
Right.
You know, if I'm reading a book and there's 5 full pages just top to bottom right in a zone out, and I'm expecting that the lowest common denominator is me in that sense. I'm going to zone out. So I expect there's going to be other people that will zone out. You know, the best you can expect is people won't zone out and will take in every bit of it. But, you know, I don't want to put people off.
And those people that can make it through 5 pages of all text aren't going to be put off by the picture breaking it up, right? So it's a win-win by doing that. So I guess that leads to Alex. Alex, how much of a pain in the ass was it to deal with all of the little things that Bud wanted to change?
Well, you know, working with someone is always a pain in the ass. Okay, even they can be the best person in the world, and it's always a pain working with someone else, right? Because, you know, anytime you're doing something creative, you know, you want your vision, you know, and they want their vision, and somewhere you find that middle ground. But I think with what works with us is actually that tension does help to make it better, right? Like, you know, he pulls for certain things, I pull for certain things, and we end up through these little frustrations here and there, we end up coming up with something better ultimately. You know, it's that friction that actually, you know, causes it to become better, I think, for us.
Yeah.
At least that was my experience with Viral. I guess we'll see what the next one.
No, I agree.
Yeah.
Oh, the next one.
Yeah, that's the big punchline at the end of this podcast is both Alex turning to Bud and say, dude, this is the last one. That was it. I can't do it again. So Alex, I want to take a similar journey with you, but obviously not about a YouTube channel. So you're playing these games, you're running these games, and anytime you're playing or running a role-playing game, you're creating, right? That's part of what this process is. But I run games and I play games and I've published nothing. And to be honest with you, I've never had that urge to publish something, but you did. And I want to get a sense of what drew you to say, I think I need to put this in front of more than just my table.
I mean, I've always wanted to publish. I mean, even back in the early days, you know, in the late 80s or so, I would occasionally submit stuff to, you know, TSR at the time or, you know, they would have contests or, you know, those type of things. But at the local game shop, I would also submit stuff to them that, you know, I would actually like do these little adventures that would, you know, photocopy at the local library after making it, you photocopy it, staple it yourself, fold it, and then, you know, ask them, hey, you know, we put up like, you know, 10 of these out and see if anyone, you know, for, you know, a quarter a piece, see if anyone wants to buy them, you know, that kind of thing. So even back then, I was doing that kind of thing.
What drove that, Alex? But why?
I guess it's a thing as a DM or GM, like you get that thrill of someone who really gets something out of what you created. They enjoy it. They have a good time. And you want to share that, I guess. I want you know, as many people as possible to be able to have a good time with this. You know, when you like to create things, you want to create it to the point where people can enjoy it. You know, I guess is the simplest answer.
So and obviously we're going to link to your Drive-Thru RPG page, which is so impressive. But I want to talk about, there's a lot of Call of Cthulhu scenarios on there. We've talked about already, you know, your love of horror. So it mm-hmm. makes sense to me that would be where you would exercise some of your creativity. And maybe the easiest way to do this, Alex, is think of one of those scenarios that you have up on the site. I'd like to get mm-hmm. a sense of your process. So pick a scenario and walk me through when the idea of that scenario was born.
Well, I guess I'll go with Highway of Blood, since that's still one of my favorites. And really it came out of the idea of once I had done the pipeline, which was really the first Call of Cthulhu one that I did, you know, I realized that it could be done. And so I wanted to do something, you know, bigger and better. And but I wanted to do something that was different than everyone else. Like I never really resonated with the 1920s. You know, I've played in, you know, the classic right. era and that sort of thing, but it was never, you know, never something that really resonated as well. But I grew up in the 70s, right? I grew up watching grindhouse movies. I grew up watching The Hills Have Eyes and Texas Chainsaw Massacre and all these kind of movies. And that was my thing. And so, but there was really not much in that era at all. And so I thought, okay, well, here's a niche that no one's doing anything in. So I will try and do something like that. And so, the first thing I knew that I wanted in it was a car chase. There's got to be a car chase because, you know, you think of like, you know, like White Line Fever and Vanishing Point and all these great car chase, classic car chase movies of the time. And one of my favorite grindhouse-ish movie was Race with the Devil, which is basically this nice. these two couples in a Winnebago who are traveling cross country, and they inadvertently piss off a satanic cult who begins trying to hunt them down and kill them. And it's just such a great movie. And all of that sort of inspired, you know, the origins of this. And then it sort of began fleshing it out from there, you know, setting it in West Texas during a heat wave. I've always been into, you know, having the environment as a big feature of scenarios and adventures. And so, you know, having this sort of desert isolation is just absolutely great for that sort of thing. So it just kind of grew out of that.
So Alex, you do some of the blocking at that point, right? You figured out some of your mm-hmm. touchstones, some of the feelings and environments you want to invoke. And what is the next step then? So you've done the blocking and tackling. I literally have no idea what I would do next in that scenario, but you do because you've done it so many times. So now that you've gotten that figured out, now what?
Oh, I do quickly want to point out that I didn't just write that on my own. I wrote it I wrote that with Ian Christensen, who is my other sort of co-writer. We've done a couple things together now. And
but he's not on the show. Just take credit, Alex.
No, I mean,
well, then let's talk about it as a partnership then, Alex.
Well, anyway, so what at that point, what we did was we just started to. I think we ended up doing like a first early play test at like 40% done. So there's very little. We just had sort of a framework. You know, we came up with this fictional town called Abattoir, Texas, and sort of wrote a little backstory for it and began to flesh it out. But then we wanted to sort of test out the initial part of it, especially the car chase, which was sort of a key feature of it. And so we began to sort of play with it. And in that process, we began to improvise and, you know, come up with ideas that we would write down. And so it began to sort of grow out of that. So, I mean, honestly, I tend to start with bullet points. Like I know what, you mm-hmm. know, what sort of either chapters I'm going to have or what locations or features or whatever. And then you just kind of begin filling in here and there as you go along. You know, you start filling in those blanks, you know, it's kind of like that joke. You know, it's like I just wrote this book. You know, I finished the cover. Now all I got to do is fill in the rest. That's kind of how I do things.
Right?
Like one thing I do is if I get an idea for a scenario, if I'm really excited about it, one of the first things I'll often do is make a cover for it, which is just completely not the way you're supposed to do it. But and I don't always stick with that cover ultimately, but by making that cover, it just inspires me so that I can, you know, when I go to open that document, and I see that cover, I'm like, okay, I know what, you know, it gets me back into that place. You know what I'm saying?
I do. Now, is there a structural template you work from, or is there kind of a pattern you like to shoot for? You know, when someone's writing a novel, you know, it's three acts and, you know, not every novel is, but you know what I'm saying, right? Mm-hmm. Like, is there a structural approach to when you create scenarios?
I think, I think most people would agree, most of my scenarios tend to be a lot more sandboxy than others. I tend to have a lot of places that people can go, things they can do. And I don't like to include any kind of no-win scenarios. They can be very difficult scenarios, but, you know, there's usually at least some way out. There's a way they can survive. There's a way they can, you know, persevere. And, you know, because that's sort of one of the things that people have stated they don't always like about Call of Cthulhu is that it's like, well, you're just going to die and go insane in the end no matter what. It's like, well, not necessarily, you know, it's quite possible, but it's not necessarily a foregone conclusion either. So I like to leave as much available, you know, to the players as possible enough, you know, in terms of player agency.
So there's Alex, a lot of people have ideas. A lot of people start jotting down notes. A lot of people put together bullet points. A lot of people start writing stuff. Very few people finish. So I would be curious to know, how do you push through what I hear is one of the hardest parts, which is at the very end, putting, you know, the final touches, sanding off the corners. Do you have a way to get you to that point where you can say it's ready?
I think you want to shoot for perfect, but you have to settle for 80%. You know, I think that's sort of what it boils down to. You know, you have to reach a point where, you know, you could go over it again and you could add this thing in and you could do take this thing out, you know, but at some point you just have to say, you know what, this is, I'm just going to go with it, because if I just keep waiting and, you know, going over and over it, it's never going to get out there. You know, it's never going to be done, you know, so you have to reach a point where you just decide it's. You know, this is good. And, you know, it works. So just put it out there.
And speaking of put it out there, this is an aspect of creating this type of content that fascinates me, which is, you know, you play tested at your table, you build it on your computer, you have friends read through it, you have your whole process, but at some point you let go. And that thing goes out there and it's not yours anymore, right? People are picking it up and making it theirs. And what I'm always fascinated by is what comes back from that. So can you think of some feedback you got, a review you got, a comment you got that just surprised you, and it could be delighted you, or like, what the hell did he read? Like, how does that, like, I'm really interested to hear what it's like to have that echo come back.
Honestly, some of my favorite things are...
Have you ever been surprised?
Oh, yeah. I mean, honestly, I'm sometimes surprised when I go back and read something. Like, if I go back and read The Pipeline after not reading it in a while, and I read something that I wrote, and it's like, yeah, it's pretty good. Like, you don't see it in the moment, but then you go back and you reread it. And you're like,
yeah.
Well, because you've taken a step back now. Like, when you're into it and you've seen the same paragraph 100 times and you've gone over it 1,000 and you're just like, oh God, I'm done with this. But then after a while, you go back to it and suddenly it's like, oh wow, that isn't too bad, is it? But actually, my favorite thing to encounter in the wild are live plays of my stuff, because I love to see what other keepers have done with it. Like, okay, just an example of Highway of Blood is a great example because some people have done some amazingly creative things with it. For example, there's one podcast that's going to be, I think they're coming out early next year. They're releasing the audio for it, but they ran it, but they made up characters who were professional wrestlers and they used Pulp Cthulhu to run it. And it's like, that is brilliant. I need to see how that works. That's one of the best things I've ever heard. And then there was another group that ran it. They played, they were part of a drug cartel and they had arranged to have this meeting, this out of the way place. So they just picked Abattoir out of nowhere. And so now you've got this situation where you have these really bad guys fighting even worse guys, you know, and it's very much like a Dusk Till Dawn situation, right? So those are the things I really love, is seeing people play it in the wild and seeing what they end up doing with it, and often surprising me with the stuff they come up with, or surprising me with, you know, like a lot of keepers, they like to play with it, right? Which is great. So they change things around a little bit. In fact, with the pipeline, I released a second edition of it, and some of the changes I made were directly because of a live play I saw where they changed a couple of things, and I was like, that's so brilliant. Why didn't I think of that? That's so much better than what I wrote. So I talked to the guy. It's like, do you mind if I use this? You know, it's like, because I want to come out with it. I want to redo the cover. I want to come out with a new edition. So I was like, yeah, sure. So he gave me permission and I made those updates, and that went into the second edition. So yeah, I mean, I love live plays.
That's fantastic.
But one of the things that I do like reviews too, like, you guys talked about Seth Skorkowski. He's a great reviewer. But here is great, because what I like about the both of them in particular is that while they're reviewing it, they're being critical, but they're not being negative, right? Most of the reviews are, right, you know, they look at the they try to suss out the positive in it. You know, they like when you look at Seth's stuff, he's always like, yeah, it's got these problems, but here's how you could run it in a way where you can have fun with it. And I love that. You know, I'm not a big fan of the ones who are like, that's crap, you know, and then they just kind of toss it over their shoulder and be done with it.
What's gained by watching that, right, or listening to that, like, you know, I'm the same way, you know, I get sent, as I'm sure, you know, you guys do, get sent stuff and you're like, do you mind, you know, reviewing, do you take review copies? And I just had this happen recently and I said, yeah, but just so you know, by sending me a review copy is no guarantee that I'm going to put it anywhere, right? I'm not going to mention it or anything like that, because I only will talk about things where I can have a positive angle on it. And it doesn't mean I liked it, right? But I can just say, you know, this was really clever. I may not mention the 10 other things I didn't like, but there's got to be something in there. So I think that's fantastic. Now, when we were talking about horror, Alex, you mentioned, you know, how important environments are and how that's a big element to, you know, as you are designing these things. And if anybody who's already at your page right now sees these cinematic environs series that you've been doing, can we get a sense of what they are and why they exist?
Sure. They started off in as D&D supplements, actually. If you look through Drive-Thru, you can find them. You know, those are the first ones that came out. And I was approached by a friend of mine, DBJ, he has his own YouTube channel for a while. He hasn't been doing it as much lately, I don't believe, but he had this idea for doing these, you know, cinematic books about, you know, different environments and so forth. And so we sort of brainstormed about it and came up with these ideas. And then we just started to publish these different environ books for use with fifth edition D&D. And then I thought, well, you know what, I've already got the material and I think these would work really well for Call of Cthulhu. So I just took them. I sort of had to, you know, went through and, you know, redid the rules to, you know, fit Call of Cthulhu 7th edition. Obviously changed the artwork and so forth. And then, you know, sort of re-released them with that. And in fact, the pipeline came out of that, because the original idea was to have the Arctic environs. And then I thought, well, you know what? I did this one-off Call of Cthulhu scenario a while back that was pretty good. So maybe I'll just throw that on the back of it, just as kind of a bonus thing, right? And then I started writing on that, and it's like, it got to be like 3, 4, 5 times bigger than the actual Arctic thing. So I was like, well, maybe I better do it the other way around. So it ended up being released as a scenario.
Oh, that's fantastic. So guys, you know, the reason, of course, that Alex and Bud were dumb enough to say they would come on the show is they wanted to talk about Viral, and that's what I want to talk about too. So we're going to take a quick break. When we get back from this break, we're going to talk about their Call of Cthulhu scenario, Viral. We'll be right back.
You like science fiction, right? You love playing games, maybe even role-playing games. But what if you can't get your friends together for a game night? If you love games like Mothership or Orbital Blues, check out Deadbelt, a card-based space western solo strategy RPG about skillful and desperate scavengers picking over the remains of junked starships in hopes of a juicy payday. In it, you deal with lurking dangers, push your luck, and walk away with enough cred to keep on flying. Of course, you might get eaten by lurking aliens, or run afoul of rival scavengers, or face the murderous ghosts of long-dead spacers. No one said life in the Dead Belt was going to be easy. For more information on this and all of Sean and Abby Drake's games, swing over to acoupleofdrakes.com. The link's in the show notes.
So for those of you who are not familiar with Viral, I'm going to give you the little blurb that I came across to kind of set the tone and where we are. Join Marco Proudfoot, host of the successful YouTube channel, The Spectral Crew, as he and his fellow paranormal investigators journey to an island off the coast of Sicily to explore its very dark past. The only public information is a pixelated satellite map and a pile of redacted documents. But a little digging on the dark web has revealed something far more sinister. What better way to make your final push for 1 million subscribers than to stream their investigation live from the island? The crew hopes to find evidence of the paranormal, but what they discover is so much more horrific than just orbs of dust and incoherent voices in the static. Great hook. I don't know who's responsible for writing it, but that's good. That's real good. It's excellent. We've already kind of covered, you know, that this came from a liminal idea and how you guys stripped away some of the concepts in that liminal idea and, you know, and brought it together. You two decide, hey, do you want to do something together? You get to that point where you've kind of got a basic premise. You know what you're going to pull from liminal. So the part that fascinates me with the two of you is really the process, right? Because, you know, I talked to a lot of creators that work on their own, and then maybe they'll put it out there as part of playtest and stuff like that. But from the very beginning, the two of you said, we're doing this together as a partnership. And instead of having Bud describe his role, I think it's more interesting for Alex to describe his role. So Alex, what does Bud contribute, or what is Bud's role in the making of Viral and in this particular collaboration?
Well, with Viral, at least, I think the big area that he focused on primarily, especially at the beginning, was the characters, because he's really good at creating compelling compelling pre-generated characters. And he already had them in general for his liminal game, but of course they had to be, you know, sort of reworked and reskinned, and we made some other changes. But generally speaking, a lot of them are sort of based on those characters. But that was sort of the big area that he sort of was focusing on. And then on my end, I sort of started focusing on, you know, like maps and the locations and so forth. And then we sort of came together from each end of those things, if that makes sense.
Interesting. And I'll work for you, bud. Like, obviously you agree with that, but typically somebody like Alex will short sell themselves. So what do you think are some of the highlights of working with Alex, or where you think I would find Alex's biggest fingerprints in Viral?
The look and feel of Viral is a big thing. I mean, I don't know which copy of the hardback you've got. Have you got the unredacted or the normal, the original one?
You know, I'm not sure, to be honest with you. I have to look.
Oh, it's only the unredacted, actually, because we didn't do the hardcover for the regular one.
Oh, okay, that answers the question, because I have the hardcover.
Right, well, there's a beginning section in the mythical town of Perla on the coast.
Yeah.
And even the design of that was done in such a way. I remember mentioning it to Alex. It's really clever how, if you look at the pages of Perla, everything's colourful and lifts from the page. Then when you make the transition to Isola de Malamente, it all turns green, black and grey.
Yeah.
And you get that transition through. I would say, to be honest, just to react to something Alex said, one of my main things is annoying the hell out of Alex.
How so?
by saying things like, no, that won't work because of this.
Right.
Or that won't work because of this. One of Alex's big things he loves to do is create maps. And it's really evident in all of his products, that they look fantastic. And the artwork as well. I mean, some of the artwork for the next scenario is just mind-blowingly good. And I think Alex is right. We do approach it from two different ends and meet in the middle. Because I'm very kind of, I focus more on the characters and the story. And then Alex will do the kind of, he does the art, the layout. And because, as he said himself, the art inspires you to think of different things.
Yeah.
And then he does a lot of the descriptions of things like rooms, and like comes up with, hey, I've got this cool idea for this. And then we'll go, we either both give it the thumbs up, or we'll have a little discussion about it. But if it's not, we're not press. I think you'd agree, Alex, neither of us are precious about anything, are we?
No, I mean, occasionally we'll reach a point where we sort of stick to something, you know, and sometimes rightly, you know, like sometimes if you're really insistent on something, and you really believe in it, then you stick with it. But if, you know, but you have to be willing to say, I guess you're right. Or, you know what? I'm not that married to it. So either way, I'm good. You know, but that's
passive aggressive notes in Google.
So Alex, that leads to a very obvious question. Can you tell me something you fought for? Something that there was a discussion between the two of you. You may not have fully agreed, but you said, no, I know this has to make it. Can you think of something that I would find in my hardback of Viral right now?
Oh, man, I'm trying to think. I don't know, but might know better than I would if I fought for anything. I don't recall fighting for anything particular.
Bud won all the fights?
No.
There wasn't really a lot of fighting.
He would just change it, and I hope I didn't notice. Like, there was one thing he doesn't think I noticed, but I did notice, is the guy who takes them to the island, I changed it so he smoked menthol cigarettes, which I thought was an ultimate act of irony, given the fact that he's taken him to, you know, spoilers, a disease god, but he's smoking menthol because they're slightly better for him. And Alex just changed it back surreptitiously to normal cigarettes. And I don't think Alex thought I noticed, but I did notice. Oh,
honestly, I didn't notice either. So it's on both of us, because I didn't even notice I did that. It was unintentional. So, because, yeah, I would have no... No thought in that. no person that race.
No, it's based on a guy I used to know who used to,
is it?
You know, go to a nightclub, pop any pill that was handed to him, but would only smoke menthol cigarettes because they're better for you.
So we talk about the art, we talk about the story and the characters, but someone has to write the words. So I'd like to get a sense of the copy. Are you writing some and throwing it to each other? Like, how does the copy end up coming to life?
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much it. We'll often split it out into sections, won't we, Alex?
Yeah.
I'll say, I'll write this bit, and then Alex will go away and write another bit, and then we'll both take a look at each other's, and we'll offer tweaks either way. And normally we come to a happy compromise. I would think that
Yeah, I think that's fair. Like, yeah, look, we'll try different sections. Like, we'll come up with a list of things we need to fill out. Essentially, remember, you know, like I talked earlier about, you know, you have the bullet points, and then I'll say, okay, well, I'll write this section, and I'll write this section, and then we'll go over it and look at it and say, you know, what a great idea that is. So, what if we added this? I mean, generally speaking, I think we try to both yes and not no, but. Sometimes we'll tweak it. I think we both appreciate each other's style, and we try not to change it too much. But I think usually what it's more about, it's about making sure that things match up, consistency throughout, I guess, is the right word to use.
Yeah, and this is where I'm going to head on this, because I'll be honest with you. And this is something that really impressed me, by the way. If I tore out the first few pages of that book and read it, I would not have guessed it was a collaboration, because there is a single voice that goes from beginning to end in that scenario. And I have really no idea how that's possible with both of you being involved in the writing of the copy. Was that a conscious thing? Do you guys just think enough alike? Or how did you guys get it to sound like this was made by the same voice?
I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I think Alex will agree with me when he thinks about it, is it's a lot to do with the editing. Because we had Pookie editor. Pookie's a renowned editor.
Got it.
And he was very much, you've got to come in at this from the same angle. Like, what Americanisms do you use? What Englishisms do you use?
Mm-hmm,
you know, like, we had the discussion about, do you call it a helicopter or a chopper? With that kind of thing, that kind of granular level, we almost had an argument about that. but I mean, for example, the intro script where the email that Marco sends the rest of the crew to say we've got this thing, I kind of already had that written for the liminal one, mm-hmm. and it was just a few tweaks, and it was good to go.
Yeah,
you know, and then Alex would just take what I've written and. Then he would base what he'd done on that, and then I would take what he's written and then base the next bit I've done on how he put it together. I think it was a proper collaboration.
Yeah.
In that, you know, it wasn't just one person solely responsible. We had, I mean, for example, the whole beginner section on Perla, I was very much, look, when we go and print, I think we should offer something extra because I love stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I sat down in like 3 or 4 hours and wrote the entire thing, Perla. And then sent it to Alex, and he just went tweak, 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 tweak. And there we go. And it was like, yeah, it's perfect. You know, it was, there wasn't much we had to do with it beyond, you know, someone putting the layer of fairy dust one way or another.
Yeah. But do you think you guys clicked out of the gate, or did it take a little bit of time to get used to working together?
It took a little bit of time, but we played enough together.
Right.
With Impossible Landscapes that we kind of become friends over that. Anyway, and it was great to be able to go, oh, you know, we're going to do this thing and publish it. And, you know, I've got an actual book in print that I helped write. It's a weird sensation.
Yeah, I mean, I think the editing is definitely a big part, but I think there's also that we both tried to respect each other's creativity and our style, and so. Like when I would go in and come up and, you know, see something that might be tweaked on something that Bud wrote, I wouldn't try to rewrite it in my style necessarily. I would try to keep it as close to his style as possible, but maybe switch, you know, change this around, or, you know, add this little bit of extra to clarify something, or, you know, whatever. But, you know, I tried to make sure it was still his voice, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. It does make sense a lot. So, Alex, I want to talk a little bit about the playtest process real quick. Mm-hmm. First of all, how early on did Viral get exposed to the table?
I think I should take that one, shouldn't I, Alex?
Yeah, oh,
please.
Yeah,
I ran it for the first time at Grogmeet, and one of my players was Paul Fricker.
Okay. He knows a little bit about Call of Cthulhu scenarios.
Paul Fricker got caught up by his he got found out by his own rule. You can't spend luck on a sand roll. I was like, you know, you've not got anyone to blame but yourself, Paul.
Nice try, Paul.
But I ran it as a single session for the first time in public at Grogmeet, and everyone at the end of it was like, that was great. I was like, it's really meant to be run over two or three, but I condensed it.
How baked was it though at that point, Bud?
It wasn't so much what you would call half baked. It had a few things removed. Mm-hmm. It was like a plain cake rather than, you know, a Black Forest gâteau. It was as much as I could get into one session as I could get.
Yeah.
And as it turns out, 3 or 4 hours it was ready.
It was edible, just not fancy.
So looking at the playtests as you go through it, what died or what came in as a result of playtests? I want to get a sense of the impact of playtests in the final product, Bud.
Well, I mean, I ran it 6 times, and I think Alex ran it 3, didn't you? But three, I think Alex ran it before me online. Yeah, he ran it through Discord as well. One of the main things that I picked up was things people added to the characters.
Ooh.
And we wrote them into the characters. For example, there's a friend of mine, Dr. Griffiths, and he was one of our players, and he played the psychic, Karina. And as a way of getting round, not having to do anything on camera, he claimed he was allergic to everything. So he was like, you know, because there's the lemon grove in it, and where there's the weird lemons you pick off the trees. The first thing he says, oh no, I'm allergic to lemons. And I thought, that is brilliant, and it's so the character. So we wrote it into the character that she would claim to be allergic to things to get out of doing them on the camera because she wants people to take her seriously.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. How about for you, Alex? Can you think of something maybe that was added or removed late in the process that really just made everything click together?
Let me think. I guess at the finale, this is kind of spoilery for anyone who might be listening, but at the very end, at the climax, this sort of a flight from the island at this point, as things are going badly, and there was, you know, a lot of sort of going back and forth about how they escape. Right. From this underground, this underground temple, and how they managed to get out. And, we were going over the rules on like climbing, like, cause you know, obviously, and if you give a character a climb skill in Call of Cthulhu, that's anything more than base, people immediately are suspect, right? Like a player is going to look at that. Right. It's like, why does he need such a big high climb skill? You know? So we had to figure out, it's like,
yeah, well, we had big discussions over that, didn't we?
Yeah. So I think we ended up just going with an ability check, right? To climb out, didn't we?
Yeah. Originally, cause only one of the characters had a climb skill, and we wrote it because the main character, Marco, is a fitness guy. So we gave him a climb skill because that's the kind of thing he would do. But we did discuss this. We were like, if we gave all the characters climb, they're all going to be going, we're going to have to climb at some point here.
Why, you know, exactly.
The meta game inside of your brain kicks in.
Yeah.
So we just removed it entirely and wrote a new set of rules for how to get out of the temple.
Yeah, and I guess the other thing was the idea of the taint, which was this thing they acquire as they're on the island. And, you know, when we're working on the character sheets, we're deciding, you know, we don't want to put taint on there. Cause first of all, that sounds, you know, they're going to metagame that, like, you know, this is bad. Right. So we ended up just putting like an exposure bar, which is a little more benign, you know, or at least not as ominous. So that, you know, the keeper can still have them keep track. Because I think we went back and forth with, you know, having the keeper keep track of it. Do they want to keep it secret? You know, a lot of that came out in the playtest, like what seemed to work better. Because
got it.
As soon as, you know, I try to run as a keeper and keep track of everyone's exposure there, it was just, I don't want to do this. This is not fun. Let them do it. So we just have to figure out how we're gonna call it something that's not gonna immediately, you know, make them nervous or more nervous than they have to be.
what was funny about that when I read it, Alex, and I was going through the scenario, is it shows something that I have learned recently and has changed how I run games. So I used to be captain, secret GM, right? I would love to hide things from them, roll the dice, don't tell them why, and stuff like that, thinking that I was adding tension to the table and, you know, upping the game. What I realize now, and it was Blades in the Dark that made me realize this the most with clocks, which is you put it in front of the players, you let them look at this and the things ticking by and time going down and exposure going up. And it's 10 times more unnerving and impactful than if you hide it from them. So I really thought that was clever when you guys put it in there. So the last thing that I love to do on my show, Alex and Bud, is I love to talk not only to creators about how they make their things and their process, but I love finding out what creators consume. So I'm going to start with you, Alex. Is there anything recently in the last, you know, months or years that got its hooks into you and you couldn't let go? A video game you couldn't put down, a book you couldn't stop reading, a show you couldn't stop binging. What is something that really just grabbed you recently?
Oh, wow. I'm trying to think. Honestly, I've been writing a lot lately, so I haven't really been that immersed in anything. Anything that unusual. Why don't you give it to Bud and let me think about it for a second.
Okay. So we're going to pause on Alex. How about for you, Bud? What is something that, and it can be a role-playing game, right? It could be anything, but I'm always curious to know what has done to you what you hope viral does to somebody else? What is something that's gotten its hooks into you?
Over the pandemic, I sat and actually watched The Sopranos for the first time.
Nice.
I'd never seen it before. And me and my wife sat down and watched the entire thing over a couple of months. And I purposely avoided spoilers, although it's some inevitably you can't avoid, so that I knew, I'd be surprised by the end. And I've got to be honest, I wasn't surprised by the end. I knew something was going to happen like that. As for things like reading, I mean, I listen to music more than I would sit and watch a TV show or game.
What's some new music that you've listened to recently that's really gotten its hooks in you?
The thing I've been binging about recently is Pink Floyd Animals, the new remix of it.
Oh, God. I've not heard the remix, but what an album.
Oh, the remix is beautiful. But the thing is, it's not that different because Pink Floyd recorded their stuff really well in the first place.
Yeah.
So I've been listening to that quite a lot recently. I mean, my musical tastes vary from like technical death metal to jazz. So I'll listen to a wide variety of things. I love me a ghost show, which is kind of why I got into the whole idea of viral, because I mean, a lot of the notes in viral about ghost hunting and how to pull off the ghost hunting aesthetic was from just years of me watching ghost shows.
Oh, that's cool.
You know, and often laughing to the point of collapsing how bad they were. But also when they get that one bit of creepy something they can't explain that they clearly didn't expect, then, you know, that's when it grabs your attention.
Yeah.
And that's my not so guilty pleasure. ghost and paranormal shows.
How about for you, Alex? Has Bud inspired you to think of something recently that you've enjoyed?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I like listening to stories on podcasts. For example, there's been some really great stuff from a podcast called Old Gods of Appalachia.
So good.
I've been looking for sort of more stuff like that. There's another YouTube channel called Horror Babble, which... they do a lot of readings of horror stories. They've started to make their own as well, but they've done like all of Lovecraft stuff, and the reader just does such a wonderful job. It's not made like a radio drama, but it has that kind of that the voice has a kind of quality to it. So like you can just kind of sit there, turn the light off, and just sit there in the dark and listen to this story sort of unfold around you. And those are the kind of things that I really like, and those sort of, they sort of keep me inspired while I'm writing, to get me into the mood.
So let me give you a couple quick recommendations, based off of what you just said there, Alex, if you want more, I'm a huge Old Gods fan. There's a couple podcasts. One is called The Town Whispers, which I think is excellent, and similar, in tone and Give me just a second. I'm scrolling through to make sure I get the head right. This is a buddy of mine, but this is really good. A writer named Patrick E. McLean, and he's recently been putting out an audio drama for called A Town Called Nowhere, which is a Western meets a Hiberian fantasy story with a lot of horror elements, which you might like. And where is the other one? It's called The Old Ways, but I'm not seeing it on my feed. But The Old Ways is also another good one. I really enjoy that stuff too. And it's really interesting to hear, you know, because I spend a lot of time listening to actual plays as well, Alex. It's mm-hmm. also nice to go and listen to just to a story sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, if you look at live plays like, what was it? Ain't Slayed Nobody.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've heard them, but they, they edit theirs in such a way where they sort of edit it down to almost very much like a radio drama, the way it's edited, very much so. Which is very cool.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Well, gentlemen, on a Saturday afternoon, there's a lot of really cool things you could be doing, and it would not involve having to sit here and listen to me talk to you and ask you questions. So, but I'll start with you. I really appreciate you making the time. I've been looking forward to this.
No problem.
And Alex, we survived the storm. You were able to make it. And even despite technical difficulties, it was a real pleasure talking to you as well.
Oh, my pleasure. Great to be here.
And you listening right now, you listen to the whole thing. This is the end. I appreciate you listening. Take care.
This episode. Subscribe to Tabletop Talk and share it with your friends. Check out our content on YouTube and Twitch. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook and stay updated on everything coming from Third Floor. All the links are in the show notes. Take care, floorheads.
That was perfect, gentlemen. Exactly the type of stuff I love. So thank you.
Cool.
Cool.
Yeah. So, sorry about the overtalk. But very hard. It's hard.
Hey, we got a delay. I mean, let's stop for a second and appreciate the fact that, you know, not only am I, you know, what, 1,500 miles, 2,000 miles, whatever number of kilometers it is between us and Bud, but you're in the middle of goddamn nowhere and all of us are able to do this.
That's crazy. Exactly. I try not to you know, get jaded to that because it is amazing, despite the occasional snafus with the technology.
Yeah. And with the delay, guys, like we have to play through it. So by all means, just keep going. And we all know to shut up because it's the delay and stuff like that. So I think we're navigating it great. I'm not at all concerned.
Not a problem.
All right. I'll bring us back.
Are you still here? Wow. Well, the episode is over, but if you're bored, why not go to patreon.com and support the show for as little as $1 a month? Yeah, you can just scroll down and get the link. It's Patreon that makes this and all of our other content possible. Don't you want to join the other floorheads on the Patreon Discord? Anyway, thanks for sticking around. Take care. Bye.